Before we start today's episode, let's talk about melasma. Pigmentation is something I've been battling with over the years, and my pregnancy only amplified it. One of Vitaglow's revolutionary new products, Radiance, was designed to work with your skin to combat uneven skin tone. Whether you're worried about dark spots, sun damage, lackluster skin, or like me, hormonal melasma, Radiance has been clinically studied to improve your complexion when taken daily. Taking this ingestible capsule each morning has helped me to reclaim my skin confidence. Use code VGPeaches at checkout for 20% off.
At our absolute peak, we were making, on average, like 150 grand a day US, probably. 100 grand a day US. You think when you're younger that you will arrive at this destination and be happy and done. And it does not happen.
You're listening to the Peaches Podcast, a show by Tori Clapham and myself, Beck Chidiak. This is not a show about fitness.
This is a collection of stories and conversations with some of the most inspiring people we know. This is the Peaches Podcast. I'm Tori Clapham, and this week, Beck and I are bringing you our interview with Erin Deering. Erin is the co-founder of the outrageously successful swimwear brand, Triangle. You might remember Triangle from the glory days of Instagram, when they were the bikini brand, donned by celebrities and dominating the market in a way any brand would struggle to do in today's climate. Erin went from a white-collar, middle-class upbringing to entrepreneurial success beyond her wildest dreams. In what seemingly was the blink of an eye, she was a multimillionaire living in Monaco. But every record day of sales, every designer handbag added to cart, and every stunning piece of art hung on her wall was hiding a much sadder truth for Erin. She wasn't happy, and she couldn't figure out why. Today we discuss her journey to building an iconic brand and what really went on behind the scenes. Welcome, Erin. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm very excited. Very excited to talk about myself.
I haven't seen you since we were in the Bondi studio together.
I know.
A little bit's happened since then.
When was that?
COVID.
Wow.
Everything happened before
COVID. I think there was I think life happened before COVID. Like everything happened before COVID. Yeah. But yeah, that's a while ago.
And you relocated to Melbourne.
Yes, well, yeah, I'm a Melbourne girl, so I am back here and loving it. The weather, we've had the best summer, actually, like cracker summer, so it's been really good the last few months here. It's been awesome.
I feel like Melbourneites don't often get to say that, so well done.
No, it's
I've never heard that before. Summer.
Like, that's the exception to the normal rule, you know, like summers aren't great for us. When we have one, we're like, it's been a great summer.
I feel like Melbourne deserved a really good summer.
Because we had a terrible summer last summer when we had that break from COVID in between like two of the outbreaks, and it was so shit. We had the worst summer. So this one, like every day has been sunny and warm and it's heaven.
You've earned that after all those lockdowns.
I swear to God, I don't know what would have happened if we had a shit summer. I don't know.
Everyone would have lost it.
Lost it.
Well-deserved vitamin D for you guys down there.
Yeah. Erin, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today, mainly because I know that you're one of us, a.k.a. you're an open book, and we can just take this conversation anywhere and everywhere, and it's always such a joy to speak to people like that. Because really, this is all about us learning from each other, and how can we learn from one another if we're not open?
Exactly.
And we are, as the listeners know, here to talk about how you got rich quick through your incredible brand, Triangle. Yes. But before we go there, I just want to take a step back and ask you about your pet peeve.
My pet peeve.
We just love hearing them. I want to know what annoys you.
Just for this week? Today? All right. What is it? Well, at the moment, I actually try not to have too many, but I think my pet peeve this week has been I drive quite a big car, because I have four children. So, you know, it's not a people mover. I'm refusing to move into that, but it is big. And I have driven it terribly this week. I've like sideswiped with the mirror like twice. And I really, really take pride in how good of a driver I am. Like, I just think I'm like, nail it. And that I've been just, it's like my peripherals just aren't there and it's been driving me insane. And then the more I focus on it, the more nervous I'm getting. And so, yeah, I can't drive this week. And it's really, can I swear? Pissing me off. Yeah.
So you're your own anyway, pet peeve this week.
That's that. I am. I feel like I have to own it.
I find it really interesting what you mentioned about the confidence too. Like when you start becoming aware that you're not doing a good job, like you just get worse.
Yeah. And it's just like I just keep, I'm just like losing my confidence for now. Like I'll be fine.
She'll be back on the road in no time. Yeah,
exactly. That's what I thought. Anyway, so the car's been a real issue for me this week. Boring. Sorry. That's a boring pet peeve. About me. But there you go. Car problems.
So, Erin, you are the founder of Triangle, and I think there's not a woman out there who isn't familiar with the viral Instagram bikini brand. I mean, you guys were the original bikini people. Yeah, and the ones Instagram who did, like, that knitted, like, how would you describe that style where you had...
The neoprene. Yes. So we weren't the first to do neoprene. It actually was from the 80s. It was a brand that did it originally called... like Body Glove, well, we only found out about them afterwards. And they'd been around. So it'd been a thing in the 80s. And then there was a few other brands doing it, but we were the ones to sort of, I guess, bring it to like the mainstream, most attainable market. And it was, you know, that was kind of what it was. We didn't launch with neoprene. We launched with nylon spandex, like classic bikini fabric. And then we weren't getting sort of the traction that we, you know, thought we would want or thought that was kind of just what it just didn't feel like it was going to be something that would take off. So Craig, who is co-founder, he found some really great neoprene at one of the fabric markets and said, what do you think about this? And it was something that we both thought was like really new. Like we kind of were like, wow. I was like, yeah, great. And it was so smooth and it sat on the body so nicely and didn't like move that it kind of felt like, and it just really hit the market at the right time and people just went crazy over it.
Well, take us back to, I kind of wouldn't mind hearing a little bit about your upbringing as well, because I think that that's quite relevant to the way that you handled suddenly having more money than you knew what to do with.
Yes.
So let's talk about Erin growing up and then how the brand and the concept of Triangle came to be.
Okay, well, growing up, pretty standard Aussie upbringing. We lived in a few different capital cities. I spent quite a few like formative younger years in Brisbane. We lived in Sydney, we lived in Melbourne, lived in Adelaide, but Melbourne originally. And very like standard upbringing, probably like middle class, maybe slightly upper middle class, real suburban, you know, life. That real normal, like I guess that I always had that yearning or like that burning desire to like make something, you know, like move into like you know, the like ultra wealthy or like, you know, that like just when you're a suburban kid, you just like think, what would it be like if I like, if we lived in a mansion and like all that stuff, but nothing like crazy. Like I would say my drive and motivation was probably pretty normal. I wasn't like mega motivated. I also didn't really like school, especially high school. I wasn't very driven to study or do work at all. And I didn't want to go to uni. I didn't know what I wanted to study. So I kind of was driven, but in a way that I guess wasn't applied to anything. I just knew that I wanted an extraordinary life. And when I look back, at the time, obviously couldn't attach that to anything. But looking back on reflection, I've always, I think, believed that I would have an extraordinary life. And I believed that I was special and different and going to make something out of my life, which, you know, I had no other, like I had no real skills or real like passion for a particular thing, just that feeling. And when I look back on it, I'm like, was it the fact that I just thought that I was special enough to make me do special things, you know, like that belief in myself of like, you know, like maybe like, I mean, I think everyone might just be like, everyone is special, but I was able to unlock that like feeling of really like, I guess, manifesting it in a way.
Even what we touched on with the driving.
Yeah.
With your pet peeve, confidence comes down to so much of what we do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just like something that I think I'm kind of born with, I guess, just that like believing in myself. I mean, still total, I've always had self-worth issues and you know, I'm not like, I don't float through life like thinking I'm untouchable. Definitely have issues, but I have this like, you know, even with my next sort of projects and I have a belief in myself, which I think really helped, just that knowing that like, or feeling like something amazing was going to happen or I was going to do something or I don't know. Anyway, and then, yeah, so kind of left school and worked in retail and definitely was living a fairly ordinary life for a good decade in my 20s. And was working in, always loved fashion, obviously. That's like a huge part of my life. It brings me a lot of joy. And I kind of, you know, was a bit, and up until really recently, have been a bit sort of separate from it in terms of I don't want that to define me. I felt a bit like it was too silly to be defined by how much I love it, but it brings me so much joy and it makes me really happy. And I think that it gives a lot of other people joy through the fact that I'm loving it so much. So I'm owning it a lot more now.
Well, fashion's just art, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I used to put a lot of import and felt silly for saying that, whereas now I really own it. It's like a huge part of who I am. It's
how you express yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, I really love the whole part of it, the whole, you know, so I've always been in fashion, didn't really know if I wanted to work in it. So I went into quite standard roles like product development and buying and just trying all those typical things. Cause I was like, oh, maybe I'll be a buyer and I'll like go to Paris and New York. And then you get into buying and it's like sitting in front of a spreadsheet pretty much every day. And you're like, wait, this isn't glam. So there were all these little learnings that I had about different things and was working in e-commerce just before Triangle, within like a fashion company. I did a bit of e-commerce, which I really liked because it was new. It was very personable. Coming from retail, I really loved that customer, you know, connection and talking to different people every day. And I felt like online was even easier to build a rapport with someone because it was over a longer period of time. So you were able to kind of nurture a customer. And even if you weren't in a great mood, if you got an email, you were able to really always be lovely and nice and friendly. Whereas in a store, if a customer came in and you were like wanting to go on lunch or you just weren't feeling it, you're a bit grumpy and a bit tired, it was really hard to be nice to a customer, like in a retail environment. I still think if I went back into retail, I'd probably be the same. I'd be like, oh, fuck off. Like, whereas in e-commerce, it was always like you get an email and you'd write back and be like, hey, how are you? Like, it was so easy to be friendly, like so easy. So I love that side of it. So I really, you know, that really benefited us with Triangle. Like it was really, because it was so easy for me to do and I really, really loved it. So I was working in e-commerce, met Craig, who is the co-founder. We sort of started a personal, intimate relationship fairly quickly.
Did you just meet at like a party or?
We met We met at a bar in Melbourne and he was like probably the kind of very exactly what I thought I wanted. So like I was 27 years old. I just turned 27. He was 10 years older. I walked into a bar. I saw him straight away. I kind of knew who he was because he had a bit of a profile in Melbourne at the time. He's an ex-footballer, AFL, and a fashion designer. And I was like, well, that's my dream man. Like, really, like, tall, dark, handsome,
tick,
rugged.
Tick, tick.
Like, literally, like, if you'd written down on paper what I thought I would want, that was it, you know. So we got into a relationship really quickly, moved to Hong Kong 6 months later to start the business. Real whirlwind. And yeah, Triangle kind of started from there, really.
So how do you go from dating a guy to moving overseas to start a bikini business?
Like, well, he was very ready to do it.
What was he doing at the time?
He'd had a fairly successful business, clothing business in Melbourne, called St. Lenny. I don't know if Melbourne people would probably know it, older. Melbourne people. And that went bankrupt. So he was just working as a denim designer for another company when we met. So he'd always been in fashion since playing footy. And he really wanted to start a business. And he couldn't do anything until the bankruptcy ended, because you can't be a CEO or a director while you're bankrupt. And it's like a 5-year thing. So it was fortunate, you know, timing for him, I guess, that he met me and had then like a partner to, you know, do what he wanted to do. I probably would have been a bit, I guess it was probably a bit hard on his own to do it. So it all kind of worked out really well. And I was like, of course, oh my God, yes, let's do a business. And having no idea what that looked like and no idea the work that would go into it. I thought it was all very much like, you know, just da 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 da.
Even the words, let's do a business.
Yes, yes, it all. Okay. Let's move to Hong Kong. I've never visited that city, but let's move there. So, oh, you know, it was all very like me just kind of going along with whatever, because it's, you know, there was no good reason to say no.
Would you say that you were sort of a muse and you were a way for him to connect with the target market? Because
I think probably, I would say so. I don't know if he would probably refer to me as a muse, but I guess I probably was. Yeah, you know, I think. But doing it, like, I mean, he couldn't do a swimwear business on his own. Female swimwear business probably would have been a bit challenging and a bit hard. I would say that was probably that. And I had my, you know, even talking about it now is still, I guess, a little bit uncomfortable for me sometimes, because it was really hard for me to find my place in that business for a long time. At the very start it was hard because I'd never started a business. So I was relying on Craig a lot to help me understand how it all kind of worked. And then I found my little groove sort of for the like sort of 3 years. And then when it became really successful, lost my way again, because I'd never run a multi-million dollar business or, you know, been, so I lost kind of like how to do that. So Triangle was an incredible learning experience at different points for different reasons. But in the start, it was pretty full on. You know, we had no money. We had no money. We were, you know, living overseas in this tiny apartment, and it was just him and I. We had no friends and no family and no reference points. And we just had to really, really believe in what we were doing and just keep pushing forward, even though we were just felt like we were being pushed backwards by, you know, nothing working or constant like money woes and manufacturing woes and, you know, sample woes and all those issues. But we just had to keep pushing forward because we put ourselves in a situation where we couldn't even afford to return back home to go find, and we just were probably both too proud at that point to do it. We were like, we have to try it. We have to find a way to make this work.
So can I ask for anyone who wouldn't understand, you know, as well as people who might work in fashion,
yeah.
Is moving to Hong Kong like a bit of a standard move if you're like, so you're wanting to be closer to like production,
yeah,
and that kind,
yeah,
of thing?
So for us, it was definitely a supply chain benefit. You know, if we'd stayed in Australia, getting samples back and forth from China would have been a really lengthy process, and it would have dragged a launch out by like a year. And also we wouldn't have really given it our all if we hadn't taken ourselves out of our comfort zone and put ourselves in a really uncomfortable position. I think one thing I've learnt on reflection, you know, since Triangle or even, you know, through it, is that fear place and that fear state, and even though it's like, or uncomfortable state even, that's where the growth really comes from. You know, so it's like, even with what I'm trying to do now since Triangle, I feel really uncomfortable about it in a way. And I know that means I'm like onto a good thing, because it's like, you know, yeah, you know, things can come from safe places and it's all like happy and like easy. But you really, really have to dig deep when you feel a bit like uncomfortable about something. And I think with Triangle, that feeling of feeling really like just not knowing what was ahead and not knowing how we were going to do it, but just having to totally rely on your skills and your belief in yourself to make it work, and like not giving up, even though, you know, you're just so like bewildered at what to kind of do next. I think that was really key to us kind of growing, because we just had to keep putting one foot forward in front of the other, you know, to make it work. So, yeah, so Hong Kong was a decision for both, I guess, being uncomfortable and being committed, and also supply chain, because we manufactured in China, and well, living in China was, I guess, not really an option, because where the factories are is not really, Western people wouldn't really live there. But Hong Kong is like a really global city and really fun. So it was like, let's do that. Let's live there.
Cool. And so before we get into the brand kind of exploding, can you just quickly touch on like how you made it happen in terms of money? Because I think there'd be a lot of people out there listening going, but okay, how did they start? Like if they didn't have any money, did they get a loan? Like where did you get the money to?
And going back also, we haven't heard exactly where the idea came from. Touching on it quickly for anyone that hasn't heard, like to decide to do a bikini brand with your partner.
So it was actually very sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? It was really sort of authentic and genuine. We had our second date. We went to the beach, and that's a very intimidating second date. You know, we hadn't slept together and barely kissed. So it was like, oh, I'm going to be in a bikini, you know, at the beach with this really, you know, fit, handsome man. I have to get a new bikini because I just had terrible bikinis, like cotton-on options. And cotton-on back then was not as good as it is now. It's much better now. But back then it was like real shit. So I was like, I needed something good. Like I need a good bikini. So I went out the next morning before we caught up for our date and went to Chadston, which is a big shopping center in Melbourne, and ran around trying to find a bikini and found it really hard. I wasn't a bikini girl, so I didn't really kind of know what was good and what wasn't, and I didn't really have a good sort of understanding of swimwear, but there was nothing out there. There was surf brands and Cotton On, and then there was like Zimmerman, which was, you know, $160 for a bikini, which when you're, you know, on a $40,000 a year salary, that's like a lot of money, you know, on a tiny, tiny like piece of fabric. And so I ended up getting the Zimmerman bikini for a complete lack of choice, and I wanted to, you know, impress him and look good. So then as soon as, you know, and we like go down to the beach, and he was like, oh, I love that bikini, it's so nice. And of course I can't,
you know,
play it cool. So I was like, well, this is like what happened, blah, 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 blah. There's no bikinis. And I must have sold the story very passionately of there's no bikinis for someone like me who's clearly, you know, into fashion and loves it, and couldn't find anything that was on the level that I would, you know, want without spending over $100. And he was like, oh, and he's the class, like Craig is such an entrepreneur. Like everything anyone says is, oh, that could be a business, like that kind of person. And so of course, and I didn't know that he was like that at the time, but he was like, oh, that's like a great idea for a business, like fashion based swimwear. You know, that's price pointed between surf brands and higher end luxury sort of, you know, swimwear. And I was like, well, yeah, that's a huge, I don't know a single, and there wasn't a single brand that we knew in the Australian market that was filling that gap. So I still think filling a gap and finding a niche even today is a huge, you know, plus when you want to start a business. If you have something that isn't out there yet, that like, and you can identify a customer base or identify a big gap, then like you've got something there and you probably need to explore that. So that was how Triangle came to life, wow, really, on that second date.
And let's step forward to you guys being like, all right, we're actually going to do this. If he was bankrupt and you're a 27-year-old retail worker on 40 grand a year, how do you fund the project?
Well, we had to borrow money. We sold everything that we had in Melbourne before we moved. I think we had about $10,000, but that was really just enough to sort of get by initially. It wasn't really enough to do anything, obviously. You know, you have to manufacture and live and pay for samples and get a little bit of, you know, marketing or packaging.
$10,000—that is insane.
We had $10,000.
This global brand with
that what? Ran out really quickly, and then we had to borrow money. So we borrowed money. We asked everyone. Most people, we asked like my family, Craig's family, and pretty much not like obviously none of my friends were all in our 20s, so we were living paycheck to paycheck. But Craig obviously was older and had friends that really, really good friends from football days that were really smart with their money, and they had money. So we had two of his best friends lend us the money. One lent us $25,000. And won $5,000, and that's how we had the money. So wow. Without getting a loan from them, there would have been no Triangle at all. We wouldn't have been able to do it. When we asked them for money, that was our. If they say no, we're back home, like we're done. So because we couldn't have got a bank loan, you know, we weren't obviously in Australia anymore, and neither of us would have had sort of, I guess, the any credit rate, you know, there was no way we would have got money from a bank.
Was there an element?
But we didn't have much.
Was there an element of both of your families? You mentioned that you asked your families and it obviously didn't come to fruition. Was there a element of your families almost judging the situation, being like, these two lovebirds have run off and they think they're going to start a business?
Oh, yeah.
You know, because yes. How long had you been sort yes. of an item for at this point when you
we'd
started?
We'd been together for maybe like a year at that point, or we met a year before, so
it's fresh. Like
9 months, 10 months maybe, so it was pretty fresh. And they knew Craig had been bankrupt and had that, like, you know, kind of like, and you know, it's funny because what I learned through that bankruptcy sort of experience, and I wasn't with him when he was really bankrupt, it was at the end of it, but what I've learned is that it's really actually probably not something to be ashamed of, because the it's people actually having a real crack,
yeah,
and maybe making some bad decisions, but we all do, but ones that actually cost them a business. Like it's not, you know, when I was younger, I used to like think bankrupt, oh, they're corrupt and like a criminal kind of thing. Yeah. Whereas it's actually like people that, you know, and Craig's probably an example of that, people that have the ability to turn something into something really successful because they're so, you know, happy to take risks, and they just took the wrong ones. So they were bankrupt, and then they learned a ton of lessons, and he learned so many lessons that we applied to Triangle that wouldn't have happened if he wasn't bankrupt. So it really kind of like, you know, so I had that realization later on, but obviously at the time of us asking, you know, my parents for money, they didn't have that realization. So they're like, no, we're never going to see this again. Like,
yeah,
we're not loaning you. Plus I owed my family like $30,000 at that point, just for overspending over the years and borrowing, like, you know, $1,000 here, $1,000 there, like if I was on holidays or to go on a holiday. That my dad could never say no. He's one of those dads, but he definitely said it was a loan and I did pay it back. So I owed them money, which I love that my dad gave me everything I wanted, but also, you know, said, well, I want this back. Like, yeah. I'll give it to you, like anything you want, but that's just a loan. You go.
I was just about to say how the tables turned. You were able to fly back into Australia being like, who needs to be paid back, bitches?
Yeah, I feel bad they didn't loan us the money, to be honest.
They could have made some interest.
I'm sure they think, we could have been part of that story. But, you know, they were being really, they were worried.
They were in their own way.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. Like, and they gave me so much support. And they also did, you know, like they would transfer, because I still had an Australian bank card. So like mum or dad would transfer me, you know, like $100 to like get a wax, or like, you know, little bits of money when I needed it to do those few things. So they were helping, absolutely. But when it came to that big amount of money, I just don't think they had the money either themselves, you know. Like that's, we were asking for, you know, thousands of dollars. And, you know, my dad's like, everything's budgeted, you know, he's like, everything's got a budget. So he doesn't have that kind of excess cash to give. So
what did your parents do when you were growing up?
My dad he has his own business now. Actually, he started his own business at 60, bless him. I think maybe I inspired him to start his own business. But he was a general manager, and worked for AAMI Insurance for the entire childhood. That's why we moved around so much, because he moved around to sort of manage the different state offices. And my mum didn't work for probably maybe until I was about 10. And then went into sort of admin, executive assistant sort of work. So probably really like standard jobs of that middle class.
Very white collar.
Boomer. Yeah. Boomer kind of, you know, group, like worked, but, you know, nothing too full on. So good work ethic, both of them, really strong. Dad's works harder now than he ever has, which is insane because he's 67 and he should probably slow down, but, you know.
It keeps them going.
It does. I know, bless. He's found, like, he loves it now, so it's good. Keeps him young. But, yeah, so they were doing that. So they just didn't have the money. They didn't have the excess money. They would have if they did. But, yeah, so we borrowed money. And thank God, you know, we got money off two of Craig's friends because there would have been no triangle.
So, Erin, can you tell us how it all started to kind of snowball? So you started getting your samples and you start promoting Triangle on Instagram.
We were so fortunate. You know, our growth happened at the same time as Instagram's growth. So we were sort of like together.
Thursdays.
You know, yeah, like, you know, it was amazing. It was, you know, I'm mindful to say it was easy because it wasn't easy. But we were just at a time where if you were a good brand posting regularly, posting nice pictures, you were kind of going to get noticed because there just weren't that many people doing it. Like we were, you know, at the start of it, there was a few other brands that we knew of that were doing well in Australia, especially in the States. They were ahead of us. So they had, you know, some pretty big brands on Instagram, but we were one of the first Australian ones to kind of do it. So that really is what it was for us. You know, I really obviously loved the customer side of it. So I really nurtured our customers, nurtured our Instagram. You know, I was writing back to every comment. I had this conversation with a girl that I'm coaching at the moment, and she was sort of saying it's so hard to manage, you know, like I'm replying all day. I can't even do my work because I'm on Instagram all day. And I was like, oh, I know that feeling. And then I thought, well, actually, DMs weren't around. They didn't have a message function when we had Instagram. So it was just comments. So it was much easier than it is now. Like, imagine an Instagram with no DMs. Like, it would have, for a brand, heaven. Because you've just got to manage one, you know, whereas DMs, I imagine, are just so time-consuming for a brand now and so hard to manage. So,
fortunate. I couldn't get to the studio.
Yeah.
Can't make sure I don't get charged. It's like, well, which studio and who are you? And email us? Please email us.
I know. So we were really fortunate that Instagram was pretty simple back then. You know, there weren't stories. There was just posts and comments, and it was really easy for me to nurture our community and own it and reply and you know, and have like a little, you know, hub of people that were on there. Like, it was lovely. Like, it was really
also posting by time. Remember?
Oh, yeah, there was no algorithm.
There was no algorithm. It was like peak times. Yep. Peak times.
Yeah. 8 a.m. 2 p.m. Like, you know, and we got like when the America, and we knew to post then, and it was like, and you could post, you know, there were brands, that's why they probably brought the algorithm in, because brands would just flood with posts. Like, they would post like 20 times a day because they'd be seen. And I think that's why Instagram were like, well, no, that's cheating. Like, we're going to bring this. But then the algorithm just screwed everyone. Like, we used to get thousands of comments on our, because we, you know, had 3 million followers at one stage. So we would get thousands of comments. And then the algorithm came in and it was suddenly dropped down to like hundreds. And luckily we'd built ourselves up by then. That was at our peak. So it wasn't like, oh my God. But if you're a new brand or like just gaining traction and that happened, it just, you know, would have been devastating. Like, Instagram just has and still has so much power over everything. It's terrifying. You know, it's like nice to kind of, It's time for them to lose their crown, I think, you know. Instagram. I love it, obviously. Like, I'm not, you know, don't ban me, Instagram.
Don't cancel me.
Don't listen. It's like, they're listening. But, yeah, it's like, it's time for another platform. It's time for something else or other platforms or other everything, you know. I think, you know, it used to be Facebook and then it became Instagram, and Instagram has had such a long run. Like, where's the new platform? Like, where is it?
Well, they were trying to say it was TikTok, but I'm just too old for it. I can't.
It's so cringy, I feel. Like, it's like, I can't sit with that and have integrity over using that platform. I just can't. I just, like, can't do it.
I don't like that there's no two-way combo. Anyway, we're getting massively sidetracked.
Erin, can you please tell us, it's such a fantastic Instagram story of, like, the Instagram moment that every brand kind of dreams of happening, to give you that kind of exposure that you got.
Yes. Kendall?
Yes.
The Kendall moment. That one. Funnily enough, when she first posted, it was on Twitter. So.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
Yeah. So, yeah, Twitter's, but Twitter's no pictures. It's angry people using aggressive language. But she posted on Twitter. So the way we got to Kendall was by gifting her group of friends and taking care of everyone around her in her circle, because back then she wasn't a huge deal. She wasn't as big as she is now. She was still really young. I think she was still like 17. But we knew she was big. We knew she was, and like, we knew she was attainable and big, you know, because she, like, we weren't going after Kim or Courtney or Chloe, because they were too big at that point. So we went for Kendall because we just thought she would, and we kind of thought she would be quite a good triangle girl. Like, she fit the bill. She was always back then, like, you know, quite athletic and swimming. And so we were like, let's try and get her. She was kind of the biggest up and comer. So we gifted all of her friends and got in touch with all of her friends who had, you know, no following. Like, maybe like a couple of hundred or something, but they were sometimes tagged in. And this is before everyone was savvy with this stuff as well. So
it's
like
very strategic, isn't it?
We would see who'd you know, tagged her. Who she tagged, sorry. And then we would gift them. And, you know, it was funny because two of them were actually Bella Hadid and Hailey Baldwin, Bieber now, but Baldwin, because they were nowhere back then. They were just like, Bella was just sort of a bit of an Instagram, you know, like, bikini girl, and just wasn't Bella Hadid. Yeah. So we gifted her, we were gifting Hayley, and we built up a bit of a rapport with them. And then, you know, it was kind of, I guess, waiting and seeing if, you know, they might introduce us to Kendall or say, hey, our friend Kendall wants some. Anyway, and I woke up one morning and I had an email from, I wish I remembered the email address, but it was like Ken Face Killer or like Kenny Killer or like something like,
oh,
like kind of like at gmail.com. And I knew it was her. Like, it was that kind of, like, it was a silly, very kind of on brand for like her kind of quirky, cool personality, like just some random Gmail name with her like nickname in there, like Ken Face Killer or something, like with like four R's. I wish I could remember what it was. And it was like, oh, hey, you know, my name's Kendall. All of my friends have been getting these bikinis and they're like so cool. I love them. Am I able to get some too? And we're like, hook, line and sinker. Like, how the hell did that work out so perfectly? But it did. It, like, she just, you know, kind of, I guess, was like, why am I not getting them? Like, I'm the most famous of all of you. Like, why am I not being gifted? And we're like, because of this reason, like, because we wanted you to come to us, because you would never have wanted them if we sort of reached out to you. Yeah. So we sent her everything. We sent her like every single bikini we had, and she posted them all on Twitter.
Wow.
And that just blew up our Instagram, because she linked our Instagram on her Twitter, which you could do back then before it got bought by Facebook. It was all, you could, like, you know, link the whatever it was. So she linked our Instagram, and then that was kind of it. We just that was
game over.
Yeah, you got one post from a celebrity or a, you know, Kardashian Jenner especially, and that was like, they made your brand. They had that power back then. They don't have that now, I don't think.
Was it as simple, because I think that they've lost some of their integrity, that everyone sees those kind of women and think they're looking at a billboard. Was it as simple as the post, the followers, the sales? Like, did you notice an increase in sales almost overnight?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Wow.
And back then we noticed all those, you know, if any influencer or blogger had a good following and posted, it generated sales straight away. You could see it. Like, you'd go from selling, you know, 20 pairs that day to 50, yeah, you know, on the same day. So, like, it absolutely, you know, it was a direct, like, that's why we kept doing it. So we kept growing Instagram as our sole, you know, like, marketing platform, you know, like, push, because it was just working so obviously. Like, oh, they post that. And then we saw that on our page as our following grew. Like, you know, we would push styles that we wanted to push, and we would be really strategic about what we put up when, because it would just generate in sales. So it was really so simple, you know.
It often is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's like, if you just really, you know, keep it, you just got to keep it simple. Like, people get lost in, you know, marketing ideas and trying to be whatever. And it's like so simple. It's like product and customer and just like finding a way to really simply bring them in, you know. It's not that hard, but then I guess it is that hard, because otherwise everyone would do it.
It's different now, I think.
It's so different now.
When was the moment? Obviously, the Kendall moment was a big one.
Yeah.
But after that, when things continued to snowball, is there a moment in time or a day in takings when you realise, like, holy shit, like, this is working and we're making an insane amount of money?
There were probably a lot of those moments. Like, it kept happening. Like, we kept having those moments, but at the same time, always having this fear that you would wake up one day and sales would stop and you'd sell zero. Because you just, like, because it was growing so quickly and kind of out of nowhere and sort of off the back of, like, Instagram, really, you know, you kind of felt like, is this real? Like, is this tangible? Is this going to stop one day?
You're
like,
probably thinking, why are so many women needing so many bikinis?
Yeah, like, and it wasn't that many, but it was like, you know, at our peak, we would have been selling 2,000 pairs a day maybe, which was crazy. But then you're also like, well, that's nothing, because you kind of think of, like, the whole world, because we'd kind of cracked that American market quite a bit. So we were selling way more over there than we were in Australia, and they became our number one market. So we really focused on them, and we posted at a time that suited the States more than Australia.
So selling 2,000 bikinis a day at, yeah, what, $100 a pop, $80 a pop?
Yeah, say 100 probably.
Yeah, wow.
Maybe like 100. Yeah, so it's a lot. Like, we were at our absolute peak, we were making, I would say, like, on average, like, 100. And 50 grand a day US, probably. 100 grand, wow, a day US, 150, yeah.
It's like more
like
than
crazy money. That wasn't for a long, you know, like, that was our peak, which would have lasted for like 6 months. But it would have been 6 months of that every day and just, wow, be like, and that was when we started to, we just had that much interest from venture capitalists and private equity, and everybody wanted to know who this brand was, and everybody wanted to buy it or buy some of it, or, and so that just, and it just was like this, like, 6 month period of just, like, we were just flying to New York and meeting with, like, Bain Capital, which I don't know if anyone would out of the private equity world would know, but that was like, they're one of the biggest private equity firms in the world. Like, they're like $1 billion deal. They're like the private equity firm that would, like, buy Michael Kors or something, you, wow, know, like, huge, 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 huge. And we were meeting with them, you know, discussing, like, valuations of $300 million. Like, this is somewhere like a bikini brand. So it was so out of the realm, like, anything that I ever could have imagined ever happening in my life, and then some, you know, and, yeah, like, and then some. Like,
it kept, like, exceeding your expectations.
It just kept exceeding that. Like, we would call home, you know, often to be like, oh, we did this today and we sold this and we got on that person and we blah, blah, blah. And it was, like, so frequent that, you know, it was kind of like, should we even call home? Because it was like, how many times can they go, oh, we're so proud of you, congratulations. Like, it was so on another level of, like, and that's when it started to become very isolating as well, because we were like, what, like, we're so living in this alternate reality to anyone back home or anyone we know or anyone we've ever known, you know, and it was just, like, so overwhelming and super, super kind of lonely in a way, because you were like, what, like, this is insane, like, this is crazy, and is this what we want, like, because it snowballs and you suddenly have this huge business And it was still essentially Craig and I in like a really small team. We didn't really have much infrastructure at all. So it felt kind of like silly that we were like, yeah. you know, own, like having this huge business, because it wasn't a huge business in our minds, like at all. Like we hadn't scaled up to match the sales. So like we didn't have this team of 50 in these beautiful offices. We were still pretty much essentially working out of our hotel rooms when we were traveling, or we had an office in Hong Kong, but we were rarely there. So it was just felt very surreal and very hard to hold on to, you know, like it was just a weird, weird feeling and mixed emotions constantly.
Well, we've talked a lot about imposter syndrome.
Yes.
In like you and I in the studio on the Pilates mat. And yes. I think it's really amazing how we can learn from your story, in the sense that you can literally be more successful than you could ever have imagined beyond your wildest dreams, and at the same time your personal life can start to deteriorate. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
And you've and said to me previously that the peak of yeah. your success was also the peak of your unhappiness.
Absolutely, and it was. And I, this is kind of, I think, one of the reasons why I was gifted this success and, you know, kind of, I guess, gifted this story and gifted this life to tell this story, because, you know, I absolutely grew up thinking, if I have all these things, and one of my friends is Hugh Van Kylenberg, who has the Resilience Project and does an amazing podcast and has written two books, and he's incredible. And he has the if and when sort of, you know, problem, like that people have, like, if this happens, you know, then I'll be happy, or, you know, kind of, I think I've totally butchered that.
No, that's perfect.
But, you know, but I had that growing up. Like I thought, if, you know, like, of course I'll be happy. If I have millions of dollars, if I, you know, have the partner of my dreams, you know, like that I thought was my dreams, and kids and living, you know, like I'll be happy. Like you think when you're younger that you will arrive at this destination and be happy and done. And it does not happen that
I don't even think it's even if you're younger, like when you're telling your story about the success and how yeah. Triangle exploded, and you know, the success and wealth and sales that came from that.
Yeah.
That's every small business's dream.
Well, true.
But then you start to, you'll go deeper into your story, dive deeper into your story now, but it's not really what it seems. Like we just see that big explosion and be like, fuck, they're killing it. Oh, my God, I want to be able to do that. I want that. Yeah. I want that. And like even now I'm in my 30s and like, you know, you look at other brands out there and you're like, but I want that. But like what's going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, you know, it's everyone – I look at other people that are living some certain kind of life that I think, oh, that must be so good for them. And it's like, what? Like, what? I know better. I should know better. Like, I've lived it. And, like, I feel like that is, it's such a gift that I really, really want to be able to share with people, because it really doesn't matter what is going on in your physical outside world to, you know, to some extent, obviously, but in that wealth, success sort of bracket, you know, it doesn't matter if you're not happy or fulfilled or calm or grounded or whatever it is for you that you need to be within yourself. Like nothing on the outside will matter if the inside is chaos and there's trauma and it's, you know, it just doesn't. It's just never gonna, like, that's why I still feel quite detached from that period of my life, because I wasn't myself and I lost so much of me during that time. So now that I'm, you know, I kind of always think like that was my other, like my other life, or like I feel like I'm living this second life now that is separate to that life, because it really has that in my mind of totally different. Two that
different
person.
Worlds.
Yeah, I just can't even like remember or relate to that person. I can because it's me, you know. But like, it's just just such a surreal experience. And you know, it's I if I could help anyone not be fearful of, like, I guess, you know, not succeeding, because success is just like, it's just such a silly word, because it has this societal attachment to it of success, which is money and ego and power. And it's like, no, success is really individual, and it's really different for every person what success means. And if you can work that out for yourself, then you might realize that you have it already. You know, you might be like, oh, hang on, I'm happy, I like this. Like, you know, I have that now. I have to stop and check in and be like, I'm really happy where I am now. So whatever I want to do from this point onwards has to just be what I love and what feels good, and the rest will come anyway, which is all very like woo-woo and probably another 4 hours of me talking going into that, because it's like a whole big thing. But it really is, you know, it's success is not a one-stop shop. You don't reach a destination success and go, I'm here, and everyone there's like, welcome, come in.
Yeah, come on in, we're all successful over here. I love what you said about if you think about how you define success, you might discover that you actually already have successful. It. That's really beautiful. Yes. So let's talk a little bit more about the demise of your mental state, to put it lightly. Let's just go really there. Because I think a lot of people really would love to know, was there a certain trigger, or were there what were the elements of your life that were making you so unhappy? I know that we've touched previously on the fact that you were just so isolated over there. Do you think that that was a big part of it?
I think it was like it was a lot. Like, it was everything. I think, you know, they're very formative years from, you know, the period we had Triangle was 27 to, you know, or when I had it was 27 to sort of 33. So I was trying to kind of really find myself and work myself out whilst doing that. So it was just like a whole bunch of things. It was being away from family, having no support. And these were all things that I couldn't attach to it at the time. So at the time, I felt shameful and guilty, because why didn't I feel better? You know, why didn't I feel better about what was going on in my world and my life? You know, and I would always be like, have to reference what other people might be thinking of me to give myself, like, other people are looking in thinking, this is the dream, it's the dream, act like it, you know, because I wasn't feeling that. So, you know, it was a combination of no family, no support, living overseas. You know, I had a baby 3 years into the business, and, you know, managing being a mum with, you know, no support. You know, and Craig was, he's a great dad and he was a great support, but obviously he was still running Triangle with me, so he had to run Triangle and be doing it. So
it's a lot of pressure on your one relationship too. So the one person you have over there is not only your partner and the father of your child, but your business partner.
Oh yeah, and the relationship was really toxic from almost day one as well, which is a whole other, you know, discussion. And so there wasn't support from him and or that I gave him either. You know, I don't want to lump everything on him at all, because we were toxic for each other. But, you know, we made magic with Triangle and we had two children together. So it wasn't all shit, but it was not a supportive, loving relationship. So
give us some examples? Are you happy to talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, we made no time for each other. There was no romance. We wouldn't have had a dinner out together, you know, in years, which became a real problem for me at the end of it. It was like, I really value that quality time together, and there was none of that. And we just, you know, even more at the core of it, we probably found out quite early that our values weren't aligned, but we didn't realize that at the start, and we started to realize it as we were kind of already probably too far into living in Hong Kong together. We just came from different understandings of the world. You know, we were 10 years apart in age. You know, just a real misalignment of our belief kind of I guess, system, you know. So we were always going to clash, and we did clash, you know. He triggered me in a lot of ways and I triggered him, and we would have huge arguments and they would get very emotional, and it was just a really overwhelming situation to be in that got a lot worse as Triangle went on. And I guess way of handling it was to really shut down. He also was, you know, I guess would probably be quite tough on me, and I guess maybe probably blame me for a lot of things. So I had to be hyper aware of that behavior, and my reaction was then to like shut myself off so I wouldn't upset or annoy him, which really just meant shutting myself off completely. So I just became very much a shell of a person. So that was a huge, huge part of feeling terrible, because we were in this experience together and we couldn't even really share it with each other. Like, I would, if I got excited about something, it would be like, you know, like, shush, like, don't be excited. You know, like, he didn't like that I was enthusiastic, and we didn't like that I wasn't enthusiastic enough. You know, it was that kind of relationship where I felt like I couldn't do anything right. And, you know, I've done a lot of work on it since, and, you know, that's my truth, and I'm sure he has another truth and another reality. And, you know, at the end of the day, he probably felt really valid in the way that he felt as well. You know, it would have been incredibly frustrating to have a partner that was completely switched off, like I would have been to him. So, you know, it was kind of just that. And we never were able to really sit down and be honest about it, because it would just always blow up. It just was, and that was our pattern. So that was like just the way the relationship had been structured. So it was just really shit and sad and awful. And I didn't tell anyone because I felt so embarrassed and ashamed. So then it just kind of perpetuated and made it worse.
I think it's a common theme among any relationship, if it doesn't work out, that, you know, people speak so often about not wanting to admit that it's not working. I can't even imagine having the extra pressure of, we've moved overseas, we've got this multi-million dollar business. Like, how do I tell people that I'm not happy?
Oh, it was exactly that. It was like completely, it was completely just terrible. Just like, just a really sad time, and went on for a really, really long time. And then went on for a really long time afterwards as well. Like, it took me a really long time to heal from it. And I couldn't, like, we couldn't not be together because we had kids and Triangle, and it wasn't a simple breakup. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go. And home was the other side of the world. So, we were really stuck together. So
you spoke about your experience with depression. I actually really liked the way that you labelled it. It was in the Imperfects podcast, actually. I loved that interview. And in it you described your experience of depression as not being able to even smell.
Yes. Yes. So that is when I'm saying I shut down so much is, you know, when you close yourself, or what's happened to me, and I'm sure there's an explanation for it that's, you know, scientific, but what happened is that I shut down all the terrible things. I suppressed them. So I like held them in and I didn't feel it, and I just like hid it away. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, like we're living in Monaco and we're millionaires and blah. And so I'd suppress all that. And what happened is that I was started to suppress naturally all the good things, to the extent that I couldn't smell, and my taste buds were like diminished, and I couldn't enjoy my day. I couldn't be present. I couldn't, because I was so focused on this, and I'd suppressed so much. I was like just, you know, in my head and every day feeling overwhelmed by that I couldn't appreciate where I was and what was actually going on. I couldn't see the joy in joyful moments. And that really got worse. It's worst when Craig and I had separated, and I was still living in Hong Kong, but in a separate apartment. And because I was alone a lot with the boys, that was when I really started to notice it. And I started to feel really scared that I might never feel like myself again. Like I felt not like me. I felt like a shell of me, and I'd just gone and I'd vacated my body and I'd left the building kind of thing. Wow. So that was when I knew I had to make a change, and I had to change something, and it wasn't going to be fixed by whatever I was doing, which was, you know, just trying to make a nice home in Monaco.
Buy a handbag. Yeah,
exactly. You know, buy clothes and handbags, which I still, you know, have a ongoing kind of issue with, which is hard because I love fashion. I also
it's
have
coming
this
from a place of love now.
You cannot, you can't buy your mental health.
You can't. And, you know, and there is that dopamine hit when you buy things, which is normal and great. Like, I don't have an issue with that when you're feeling good. But I have, you know, I have a rule where I don't drink alcohol unless I'm feeling good. Like, I'm not the kind of person that's like, oh, I'm so stressed, I need a glass of wine. Like, I'm feeling great, let's have a glass of wine. So I kind of apply that now with other things, like, that would give me that dopamine. Like, I try not to, you know.
Feed the
beast. Who wants to, I don't want to buy a handbag that's bought out of a shit feeling because it's got bad vibes attached to it if I do, you know. Like, I'm like,
bad juju.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, it's like, ugh. So everything's out of that. So, but I couldn't, you know, I couldn't. That wasn't working, and I was trying really hard to buy my happiness to myself and trick myself into it, and I, you know, was entertaining all that material stuff to lift me up, but I was so like, this is not working. I need to go and get help and get some therapy and fix this broken person. So
even the transformation that I saw, like, since knowing you, because when you came to the studio in Bondi, you only recently come home,
yes,
and watching your sort of return to yourself, returning to Melbourne, meeting your now partner, going on top of your children. It's been incredible to watch. I mean, I feel like we could have a whole, I think we actually should have a whole nother episode because there's so much more to discuss.
There's a lot. It's like a part one, part two.
Erin, part two. But before we wrap it up, I just want to fire off a couple of fun little questions.
Yes.
Because I'm kind of dying to know. We sort of touched on, we touched on your, what are they called? Shopping, what is it called? Retail therapy. What's the craziest?
You know all about that.
Oh my God, I'm the biggest online shopper. What's like the craziest thing you ever bought in your peak of success that you look back now and you're like, Jesus.
She's probably forgotten all the
I know there was a lot. It's definitely like probably art. Oh, actually, yeah, we bought it was Craig and I. It was during, we were in London a lot during that 6 month crazy time. I think because we were meeting with private equity. I just can't really remember why we were there, but we were there a lot. And we bought a Andy Warhol original Marilyn, and we bought a Roy Lichtenstein pop art original as well.
Wow.
And they were like, that was crazy. Craig still has them in Monaco, actually, and they're amazing. The Marilyn is like, we just bought it as an investment. So it's like, and it's a real typical Marilyn that like no one will probably think is real, but it is. But the Lichtenstein's amazing. And that was, they were insane. They cost a fortune.
Oh my God. I mean, an Andy Warhol, that says it all.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I know. So that was really like that. I remember that. And we were like, should we? Oh my God, should we?
Are we about to buy it? Like,
yeah, but even like, you know, not to like bring the mood down, but even that I remember not being like, that should have been the most insane fun experience, like buying that. And I remember just only really kind of going along with it because Craig really wanted to, and it was just easy for me to be like, yeah, yes. But that would have been the craziest stuff. Art is like, you know, like fashion is fashion, but you can't really spend that much on it, like unless you start to buy like, you know, crocodile Birkins, and they're ugly anyway, so why would you want one? But art is when you kind of go, oh wait, we actually don't have that much money, like, you know, because it's like, oh, here's this, how much is that? 5 million. Oh, what do you think about that one?
We'll take a step back.
We'll walk the block and come back. Yeah, okay. But yeah, so art was definitely, that was like the craziest stuff. I mean, Craig bought like a Lamborghini near the end of sort of living in Monaco, so that was cool. I didn't buy one though. I could have. I wish I did. I wish I actually, although I wouldn't have brought it back, so I don't
wish
I did.
It would have been a nightmare to bring a car.
I know. Back. It, well, yeah. They, apparently, like, the tax on it's just insane. Like, you wouldn't do it.
Sounds like it. With four kids, you need a Tarago, though.
I know. I still want to get a little weekender. I do. Eventually. Eventually. Like, maybe. Might be more like a push bike than a
with something. Like extra seats. And Erin, finally, we touched on it a little bit partway through the episode, but you're someone who has known insane success when it comes to the materialistic world, and you've learned a lot along the way. So what would you now define as success?
Ooh. For me, I'm just going to say, because it is so different for everyone, but I define success as being able to help other people. When I have interactions, when someone, you know, if someone sends me a message and says, I listened to one of my podcasts and it made, you know, it helped them with whatever issue they're having, that is when I feel really successful, because that's what I'm, where I feel fulfilled and happy and of service and helpful, and that fills me up the most. So, you know, to be able to help people and you know, sort of solve issues that people have probably carried along with them for a really long time, or to start them on their journey of healing or whatever it is, that is real success for me. So that's kind of how I live now and where I really want to go. So
be of service.
Yeah, I know. Mm.
Well, I feel like, yes, there's a lot that Erin is bringing to the table. We'll be linking to her Instagram, and as her future business ventures develop, we can link to whatever comes next for Erin. But thank you so much for joining us, and I think we'll have you back to talk about body image and.
I know, we didn't even touch on that. That's
two.
A big one. So everyone, tune in for the next one, because that's a really nice one where I've learned a lot.
Yeah, and I think that's really going to resonate with the audience. Yeah. So yeah, we'll great. Be talking to you again too. Thank you so much
Thanks,
for joining
guys.
Us.
Thanks,
Thank
Erin.
You.